Now, Lawrence, thanks so much for talking to me. We're recording right now, if that's okay.
I see. When you say recording, is this for any particular purpose? I mean, any particular medium or something?
It's for a podcast.
I don't know what that is.
They are insane.
In the hands of an adolescent, it is a cellular peptide cake.
Inaccurate.
With red frosting.
It does like you.
And it's real!
I'm ready to irradiate your existing brain cells.
I am really, really excited today. This is where we're starting to gain some momentum here, some real thrust to this show. This is a podcast called I Just Want to Talk About Star Trek, and I just want to talk about Star Trek. I'm consuming my life with it because for the past 50 years, we've bathed in Star Trek. We have bathed in it. Have you ever taken a bath in a TV show? I have. And it's called Star Trek. This is the 11th episode. And pretty soon I'm going to be on the Feral Audio Network, where hopefully more people will listen to this, but I don't care. See, here's the thing. If people aren't listening to this, that's all right. Because this stands as a monument to the greatness of Star Trek. And someday, someone will listen to it and realize how important this was for Star Trek and for the next 50 years of Star Trek. But I've taken it on to the next step. Star Trek has now moved into another phase of my life. I'm becoming more proactive. First, I've done this podcast. Thank you, me. You're welcome, me. Secondly, big news is coming up. I'm going to the Trek Fest in Iowa this June. I may or may not be making a documentary about it, but no matter what, I'm going to Riverside, Iowa. Riverside, not Riverside. I'm not going to Riverside, Iowa. Just an old country doctor. Hey, if you haven't listened to Warp 11, they're a great band. They sing all Star Trek songs. And they're really, really thoughtful and well done. They have three versions of the Way to Eden song, Stepping Out to Eden, Yay, Brother. And they do all of those in like three different genres, like ska and country and like pop. It's really, really good. Warp 11, they're really great. Anyways, I'm going off to Riverside, Iowa this June. Because I'm going to trace back my life. This podcast is here not only for you, but more importantly for me. Because I'm not 50 yet, but I'm getting older. I'm 34 years old. I used to say that when I was 34 years old. That's from the Deadly Years, when Captain Kirk is turning older thanks to the radiation poisoning. And he looks so old, but he doesn't look like he does now. It's weird to have a show where you dress up to look like you're going to look older. And in the Deadly Years, they all looked older, but they didn't eventually look like how they were going to look like when they got older. Shatner got puffier. I guess Spock looks sort of the same. He looked a lot more jolly in his real old age. But as I get older, I try to find out who I am and where I'm going. And one of the places is through Captain Kirk. And Captain Kirk is born in Riverside, Iowa. So ladies and gentlemen, I'm announcing officially here, I've teased it many times, that June 25th and 26th, I will be in Riverside, Iowa, the birthplace of Captain Kirk. The future birthplace of Captain Kirk, as sanctified by Paramount, as we heard last week through Wendy McCracken. Listen to that episode. It's a great episode. Wendy's delightful. And I'm going to go back there. I'm going to trace my roots back to who I am by tracing Captain Kirk's roots back to who he will be. And I may make a documentary, and I may need your help in some way. I don't know if it's money. I don't think it's going to be money. I think it's going to be your help in some, I don't know what it's going to be. But I'm going to go back there because I've got to figure it out. And I'm trying every single day to figure out about Star Trek and to figure out about myself. And so here we are today. And, you know, if you've been an avid podcast listener to this, I just want to talk about Star Trek, soon to be on the Feral Audio Network, I think next week or this week. Then you know that this has sort of been a triskelion, 50 quatlus on the newcomer of different veins I'm looking at. One is that I just goof around with my friends and we just talk and laugh about Star Trek. And that's fine because sometimes Star Trek is ridiculous and dumb. I love laughing with them about Star Trek. And you should too. Star Trek is not dry. It's not just sitting around like there's, you know, all these podcasts I listen to, they're great. All these other people's podcasts, but they're really dry. And they sit around, they say, well, I thought in Cat's Paw they did a really good job with getting the cat wrangled. Oh, yeah, I thought so, too. Nobody needs that. The podcastiverse does not need that. We need excitement and action and people pounding on dressers as they sit in their bedroom while their wife is away with their kids, taking them to a birthday party for a gymnastics friend. Star Trek is all about excitement, so my podcast has to be exciting. So we have the exciting, fun part of the podcast, and then we have my intellectual deep dive where I sit there and tell you why it's important to me, why it's important to the universe. And then we have this portion, which is going to be a little of both, which is me talking about one of my favorite episodes, and then later on an interview, which I hope to happen, with one of the cast members from that episode. That's a tease. That's a tease! But what I was saying earlier was that we were starting to go chronologically through the episodes. We went through Where No Man Has Gone Before, The Cage, Where No Man Has Gone Before, and then we sort of touched upon The Man Trap, and then we tried to record one for Charlie X, but it came out kind of wonky. You couldn't hear me, and that's not good. You need to hear me. I need to hear me. I need to have a voice. In every revolution, there's one man with a vision. I wanted to say voice, but that's not true. That's from Mirror, Mirror. But I started thinking about it, and I thought, boy, I don't want to go through Charlie X and then Miri and, you know, The Naked Time and all these pretty good episodes, because that's going to put you to sleep. There's like 700 episodes of Star Trek, and if I start as most of the podcasts, and you know, these podcasts, these people are wonderful. I give them full credit for doing like 120 episodes of these, you know, and... Well, you know, when they talk about Shades of Grey, it's not a great episode. That's great. They're living their dream. They're living their passion. That's not how I live my passion. That's not who I am. So as I thought about going through all the episodes in a chronological, linear, analog way, I said no. I said negative. I said incorrect. I said non sequitur. Your facts are non-coordinated. That's from Nomad. That's from The Changeling. So I said... We're rapidly approaching September 8th, 2016, 50 years from the birth of Star Trek. So I got to move this puppy along. And I'm going to be in Riverside, Iowa in June, and they'll have July and then August, September. I can't go chronologically. We don't want to hear about the Corbomite maneuver. We want to hear about why it's important to you. And that's why I'm here. I'm here to tell you why Star Trek is important to you, why you should invest in it. I'm here to tell me why my life is important, why I should continue to invest in it. I'm not going to kill myself. Don't worry about that. But I need to figure out where this second act of my life is going to go. And you get to be part of that journey, part of that voyage, part of that trek. So I'm going on and I'm moving forward to one of the top 3 to 5 episodes of all time. And as happenstance or as kismet or as boldness would have it, I actually emailed one of the guys who was on that episode. I emailed him last night, just kind of just for the hell of it. And he emailed me back today and said, let's talk. And so talk we will about The Balance of Terror. The Balance of Terror episode, see if I get this right. This is episode number 16 that was aired, but episode 9 as it was shot. And we talked about this before, that they were trying new stuff. You got to make a spaceship fly through the stars and shoot phasers and photon torpedoes, and people have to change and transport and stuff. They didn't know how to do this stuff, so they're figuring it out. So a lot of these episodes were shot in one order and were aired in another order. Balance of Terror was shot number 9. It was aired number 14 because there were so many special effects for this. But it was worth it. In my opinion, The Balance of Terror is one of the 3 best episodes of Star Trek, the original series, and at least one of the top 10 of all 700 episodes of Star Trek. It's a bold statement, but I have lots of evidence that corroborates that. I have lots of polls and lots of lists by ridiculous people at websites who have made up their list of top 10 Star Trek episodes of all time, and it always appears there. The Balance of Terror is always there because it's such a great episode. Why is it great? It's great because it's action-filled. It has tension. But it also exposes each of the 3 big characters, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and gives them their moments to shine. It defines who they are. It gives them sort of an archetypal moment that we can trace for the next 50 years. It puts them in strong lights and in weak lights. It makes them look great, and it shows us their darkest moments. It's also a beautifully shot episode. The lighting is immaculate and beautiful, and the music and the story. The story is lifted from a movie, but that's okay, because The Balance of Terror is still one of the best Star Trek episodes of all time. All right, I stopped for a minute to grab a glass of water. I need to hydrate. You know, my wife had her birthday a couple days ago, and I ate a lot of Ruffles potato chips today. I'm not going to lie to you. They've been gone. And so I had some sandwiches left over from the party and some Ruffles potato chip and some of her birthday cake. And I'm a little dry mouth. I don't mind saying that. I mind because I have an issue with my eating. I try so hard not to eat so much food, but I just can't do it. I just can't do it. It's difficult. Here I am in my middle age, and I still haven't figured that out. I'm sort of a creature of habit. I can't escape. I can't escape what I am. We have a difficult time escaping who we are and what we are. And I love food. And Captain James T. Kirk, what did he love? He loved his ship. He loved his command. That's a segue. That's a segue into Star Trek. And that's where we start out. We start out on the Enterprise. Now, I'm not going to encapsulate the whole episode for you. Go out and watch it. Just go out and watch it. Please. Please go out and watch it, because it's that good. But we start out with a wedding, with Ensign Tomlinson getting married to his lovely bride-to-be. And they're doing it on the Enterprise. And they're doing it in their uniforms, which is a little weird. I got to be honest. It's a little weird. I don't quite understand what precipitated these two people to need to get married so quickly. I mean, maybe we do. But at the same time, it's kind of strange that they're setting up a little Scotty's setting up a little camera so the rest of the crew can watch it. And here we sort of get a feeling, though, of the stoicism of being on board a spaceship in the 23rd century. The walls and floors are gray. There's so little color in this ship. It is stark. I mean, the only thing that breaks it up is their incredibly colorful costumes. Their uniforms. Those are bold. Those are great. And on color TV, as color TV was really coming to the forefront, boy, those things really popped, and they help make Star Trek one of the most watched TV shows for color television. Had NBC known that, they would have kept Star Trek on for a few more years. They didn't realize how popular it was because of the bright colors. Because the Nielsens didn't do Nielsen's ratings on color television sets yet. They just did an aggregate of all TVs. And then the next year, they found out that Star Trek was the most popular show to be on color TVs. They blew it. But did they? I don't know. I have some theories about that too, because Star Trek third season. Well, anyway, so we start out at a wedding. It's a wedding. Two people in their uniforms. It's like if you got married at Taco Bell and you walking down the aisle in your Taco Bell uniform, and the manager's walking you down the aisle. He's giving you away. It's kind of a little weird, right? But that's what it is. That's how the 23rd century marriage takes place. But there's to be no joy here in this, because soon there's a red alert. All hands to battle stations. And the wedding will have to wait. Or will it? Or will it? I don't know if that actually links up with where I'm going to, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Because there's a problem. The outposts around the Romulan neutral zone, new words in the Star Trek universe, Romulan neutral zone, are being destroyed by something. Something's destroying them. And the Enterprise is the only ship in the quadrant. I don't quite understand, or in the area that can investigate these things. They do get one signal from one of the outposts. Some poor commander sitting there on this lonely asteroid as it's being completely destroyed by this ship, which appears out of nowhere, shoots a fireball at them, and then disappears. And then all we get to see is the cut back to the guy as he gets destroyed, and then the screen goes blank. It appears as though the Romulans are back. Now, this is a great episode because this introduces one of the two major villains of Star Trek, which is the Romulans. Romulans sound like Romans. That's not an accident. You know, in the 1950s and 1960s, America was infatuated with the Roman culture. We were looking at ourselves as world builders. Proud, stoic, world builders who had captured the world after we had defeated the Germans after World War II. And now we are going to build the world in our own image, in our own way. And the Romans, that's exactly what they did. Now, you know, the Romans are okay, but they kind of took a lot from the Greeks. So really, we would have been better served if we kind of emulate ourselves after the Greeks. But from a narrative standpoint, it's hard to understand the Greeks. But the Romans, well, the Romans made for great movies and great TV. So in the 50s and 60s, they had movies called the Sword and Sandal Epics, where we'd find ourselves in the Roman gladiator pits, fighting away with emperors who could be killed or could kill you, with honor and the glory of Rome. It was all very romantic. It really kind of captured the way America wanted to see itself. And as we have the Klingons, who are sort of like the Nazis, they're sort of like asshole Nazis, next we have the Romulans. But we don't know that much about them quite yet. All we know is that there was a war a long time ago, and we never saw them. They blew themselves up, or they were never seen. But there was a war between the Federation and the Romulans, which ended in a truce and a creation of the Romulan neutral zone. Now, this also goes to like the Korean conflict, a little bit of the Vietnam War right now. We're just starting to get into it. It's 1966. We're starting to get into that. We're getting into that quagmire. We have the demilitarized zone in Korea. So it's pretty easy to see where all of this stuff comes from. And this spaceship is invisible. Why is it invisible? Well, first of all, it's cheaper for production. But secondly, it also emulates the movie, which the writer, and I'm going to pull up his name right now, Paul Schneider, used, which was The Enemy Below, a submarine film, a World War II submarine film between an American destroyer and a German U-boat. And the U-boats were always scary because you never quite knew where they were. They were always kind of like skulking around and then shooting torpedoes, which could destroy an entire ship with one torpedo. In American movies, again, World War II movies, this was a classic confrontation. The sneaky Germans and the above board, above water Americans doing everything they could to play fair. It's no secret that this movie was sort of the prototype for the Balance of Terror. That's absolutely it's The Enemy Below. Did I say The Enemy Beneath? The Enemy Below. But that's okay because it worked. And now we have a couple things into play which will catapult us to the next 50 years. The Romulans and their cloaked, invisible ships. Okay, so the Enterprise starts pursuing the ship, even though it's invisible, starts tracing its path, theorizing that, in fact, they are, in fact, the Romulans. And if they're back, this could be big trouble. Because last time they came through, man, they messed stuff up big time. And the Federation does not want to have a war with them, but if they have to, then Kirk needs to know about this. Kirk's got to make tough decisions on this. This episode has him making a lot of tough decisions. So they start following the sort of breadcrumbs of this Romulan ship, the presumed Romulan ship. I don't want to give it away. And at one point in time, they start receiving signals. And this is where it starts getting interesting because Spock detects this signal and he says, you know, I think I can get a visual on this. A visual on the bridge of the Romulan ship. Which, you know, certainly, they have no encryption. I don't quite understand how they did that. Maybe there was some sort of backdoor that they built into it, which Spock was able to decode. But so we get a chance to look at the Romulan bridge. And we see the Romulans for the first time. And here's the thing. The Romulans are human. Let's just get that out of the way. Everybody in Star Trek pretty much looks like humans. If they don't, then it's a big thing. But they look like humans except for the fact they have pointy ears and raised eyebrows. Just like Mr. Spock. And here's where we get into the first interesting thing about the Balance of Terror, in that it deals with racism and stereotyping and presumption. Immediately, We have Lieutenant Stiles on the ship, who is the navigator for this episode. There's no Chekhov yet. He's the navigator, or maybe he's the helmsman. I don't remember which one he is. But he's there next to Sulu, and he instantly sees the similarities between Spock and the Romulans. And right off the bat, he thinks that maybe Spock is a traitor. He calls him right out. He says, well, you know, why don't you ask Spock to decode what they're saying? And I have this quote right here, because this is probably the most important part of the episode. And if you stop listening to it here, well, you're a fool. You're a fool and you know it, Jim. That's for No Man's Gone Before. But Stiles says, why don't you ask Spock to decode it? Kirk walks up to him and he says, quote, I assume you're complimenting Mr. Spock on his ability to decode. Stiles says, I wish I were sure, sir. Kirk says, here's something you can be certain of, mister. Leave any bigotry in your quarters. There's no room for it on this bridge. Do I make myself clear? Stiles says, you do, sir. And there it is. You want to look for one of the reasons why Star Trek is still around? Why, 50 years later, I'm still talking about it instead of Lost in Space or Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea or any of those other shows from the 60s? It's because of this. Because in that moment, they had it open up science fiction to something bigger than just science fiction. Science fiction is best when it takes a present-day problem or idea or concept or issue and extracts it from our time and places it in a different time, allowing us to examine it in its whole and entirety without our own judgments in the present time clouding it. Here was a situation of bigotry, stereotyping, racism pulled out into the 23rd century. Would we see this sort of thing again in science fiction? You bet. Check out Battlestar Galactica, the reboot. After 9/11, everyone was terrified that everyone we knew might be a terrorist because we didn't know what they looked like. Or we did think we knew what they looked like. Every time we saw someone with a turban on, they were a terrorist, weren't they? Every time we got on board a plane, we made sure we looked. Who's got the beards? Who looks suspicious? Maybe they're gonna be a terrorist. And so here it is in the 23rd century. And they see these Romulans look just like Spock. And Stiles calls it out for what it is. Now, maybe you're with them. Maybe you're a collaborator. And Kirk quashes it. Kirk quashes it. Kirk quashes it. Kirk says, no way. Not on board my ship. And right there, that's a bold thing to do for science fiction. It should just be phasers and lasers and monsters and stuff. But no, they said bigotry isn't going to exist here. Now, does sexism still exist on the 23rd century? Sure. Does other forms of racism exist? Yeah, they do. But it's the 1960s and they're doing the best they can. But it was a start. It's the start of the idea that humanity can be something better. And that can be reflected through science fiction. It's a great moment in the show. It's a great moment in the series, in the franchise. There will be others which are better, but this is one of the starting ones, right there. Here's the second reason why the episode's so cool, especially because we've looked at one side of the bigotry, but then we go to the other side. This episode switches from the bridge of the Enterprise to the bridge of the Romulan warship. And there we find our Romulan commander, never given a name, but played by Mark Sarek. He's a person who would figure prominently in Star Trek lore from here up into the Next Generation in several of the movies, playing the Romulan commander. And this is interesting, too, because the Romulan commander, for the first time in this series, represents a real challenge to Captain Kirk. He is his equal. He is just as smart as Captain Kirk. He is just as cunning, and he's probably seen even more conflicts than Kirk has. His friend, his older friend, the Centurion, says, we've been through over 100 conflicts before, and I still won't understand you. They've had their share. They've had their share of fights. And so what we see here is a reflection of Captain Kirk. A little older, a little more beaten down, a little tired of war. Tired because his government has demanded it. The Federation doesn't it. And again, we're putting through the lens of the American dream of this gunboat diplomacy where our way is the best. And so this is Russia. Maybe this is still Germany. But they're a lot more bellicose. They're a lot more warlike. And so this Romulan commander, He is both happy that his ship works and it can do such damage, but he also knows the terrible price it's going to inflict. And what a wonderful way to start out with a race, to see these peoples, warlike at times, but also with people who have hearts, who have compassion, who don't want war. We could have easily stayed on one side of this conflict and just seen Kirk deal with the bigotry on this side and see Spock feel uncomfortable about it and see everyone else be a little awkward about it and be scared by the Romulans, because what we don't understand scares us. But instead, the writer flipped it around and we got a chance to know these Romulans and the commander and the Centurion and Decius. That's a tease. He's just like us. And all he wants to do is go home. But something's following him. There's a reflection on their scanners that follows them. A reflection that follows them. It's the Enterprise. And he's got to do something about it. He is still bound by duty. This Romulan commander, Mark Sarek. Mark Sarek did a great job of this. Gosh, the pathos he displays in this episode. Again, if you haven't watched it, you have to watch it. Just to see his world weariness at this. He doesn't want to do this. But he has to. He is driven by duty. Much like Kirk is driven by duty. Much like I am driven to eat Ruffles. He has to do these things. So he turns the ship around and he fires on the Enterprise. And now we're in the soup, aren't we? He fires on the Enterprise and almost destroys it. Almost, but not entirely. The Enterprise sits there playing dead, all systems powered down. The Romulan ship does that as well. Again, this is completely a submarine war movie. They shut everything down to kind of run silent, run deep. There's no noise in space. There's no sound in space. But everyone still turns off all the lights, most of the lights, and they kind of walk around super quietly for like 9 hours. They wait. They play this waiting game, as they did in the World War II movies, where the submarine would just kind of sit at the bottom of the ocean and wait to see if the destroyer is going to go away or what. So they're all sitting back there. And this is where we get a great McCoy moment. As I said, we get to see all these characters in their element. And here, after being so brave and so strong, Kirk goes back to his quarters. And he's just dead tired. And he doesn't know what he's doing. He doesn't know why he has to do this. What's it all about? And that's when McCoy comes up to him and says, and I'm going to pause this right now so I get this right. All right, I'm back. I'm not infallible. I'm not a computer. I don't have every single quote figured out. I know most of this quote, but it's such a good one. I don't want to get this wrong because this is, again, it's a little bit of poetry. Earlier on, McCoy had kind of called out Kirk saying, boy, I hope you're right about this. I hope you're right about starting a galactic war on a hunch. And here, Kirk is at his lowest, and McCoy brings him a drink, and Kirk says, I don't know why I'm doing this, I don't expect an answer, and McCoy says, I've got an answer for you, and he says this. He says he got it from, I heard it from a salesman once, which doesn't make any sense. That's kind of a ridiculous line, just discount that. But he says, quote, in this galaxy, there's a mathematical probability of 3 million Earth-type planets, there's actually probably more right now, and in all the universe, 3 million galaxies like this. And in all that, and perhaps more, only one of each of us. Don't destroy the one named Kirk. And there it is. That is what Kirk needed. That is his sort of all is lost second act moment. I write screenplays sometimes. And that is his all is lost moment. He needed to find that magic feather to be Dumbo again. He needed to find whatever it was, that green crystal to be Superman again. He needed to find that, and it's in McCoy. That crazy, cantankerous southern old gentleman who gives him that. McCoy isn't in this for a lot, but when he is, he dispels these little gems. It gives him the strength to go back and fight this Romulan commander. Meanwhile, this Romulan commander has his own problems. He loses his Centurion friend. And again, if we're doing the Kirk Romulan commander theme here, the sacrifice the Romulan commander has made is already even greater. He's lost his Spock or his McCoy. Probably more his McCoy, because this guy is definitely, he's a lot more compassionate. And here, McCoy shows compassion. The Romulan commander has lost that. Instead, he just has Decius. Spoiler. So, as they're getting ready, as they're still sitting quietly, Spock accidentally presses a button, one of a billion buttons on the spaceship, and somehow alerts the Romulans. But Kirk, boy, he figures it out too. He turns around, he blasts them. And Decius says, How? He's a sorcerer, that one, says Mark Leonard. Mark Leonard's not that old, but he always seemed like he was older. One last thing they have in their bag of tricks is they put a nuclear bomb in the debris field, and the Enterprise stumbles across and blows itself, hits it, and almost blows itself up. They're laying there dead. And Decius, spoiler, says, glorious, glorious. The Romulan commander just wants to go home. He's done. He's crippled them or destroyed them. He doesn't know. He doesn't care. He just wants to go home. But Decius, young, up-and-coming Romulan lieutenant, wants to have the glory of the kill. So the Romulan commander sighs heavily and turns the ship around to destroy the Enterprise. And they might have done it too. There was a coolant leak in the phaser control room. Now, in this episode, we have this weird phaser control room where Kirk says fire to Mr. Sulu. Mr. Sulu pushes a button that says fire. That information goes to the phaser control room where someone says fire phasers. Then a dude in front of a button pushes a button that says fire. That's how you fire the phasers. Seems a little inefficient. Seems like it's padding with a lot of people there just to kind of get it done. And Stiles is there now because one of the guys got knocked out. And so Stiles goes over there. The Romulan warship appears. It gets ready to shoot its fireball. Kirk orders it to fire. But everyone's knocked out by the coolant gas, including bigot Stiles. Spock is nearby. He goes in, he saves Stiles, and fires the phaser, crippling the Romulan ship. Kirk orders the surrender of the Romulan ship, and for the first time they see each other face to face. Well, at least the Romulan sees Kirk face to face. He orders him to surrender, prepare to have survivors beamed aboard. But the Romulans don't do that. No. No, they blow themselves up. That's why we didn't get to see him 100 years ago. And then the Romulan has something, the most poetic line out of all of this, even more poetic than what the salesman said to McCoy. He says, I regret that we meet in this way. You and I are of a kind. In a different reality, I could have called you friend. I feel like that with some people. I'll be honest, I kind of want to have Dan Harmon on this episode because sometimes I feel as though Dan Harmon has written Community and Rick and Morty and all sorts of shows. And he's a great funny guy, and I'm a great funny guy. And sometimes I feel as though we're cut from the same cloth and that we're just different. We never quite get along. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's him, maybe it's me. But whenever we're together, we never quite click. And I always feel that in a different reality, we could have been friends. But now, we're on the opposite side of a battlefield. Dan Harmon and I. Dan's winning quite a bit. I'm in the Romulan ship. I'm going to blow myself up. I'm going to eject my family. They're going to be at a swimming party up in Northridge. But me, I've got to pull the lever right here. And so does Mark Leonard. So does Romulan Commander and blows himself up. Well, they saved the Federation and the Romulan Empire from a big war. Hooray for everyone. And there's only one casualty. It's Tomlinson, the boy who was going to get married. Ugh. Kirk has to go back into that stark, terrible chapel and talk to Angela. Angela, the bride-to-be, who's sitting there. And now it's not only a chapel, but it's also a church, and now she's praying. Kirk goes there. He says, doesn't make sense. And then she looks at him, she just smiles and says, I'll be all right. Which also doesn't make any sense. Why is she going to be all right? Her husband-to-be is dead. But the coolest thing about this episode is they don't end it with a joke. Is that Kirk walks off. And as the credits roll, we see him walking past all the people in the corridors, relieved that they're not going to war, relieved that they're not dead, that they're not injured. But Kirk has to bear that burden. The burden of command rests heavily upon his shoulders. And we see it. We see it weighing down on his shoulders in this episode. I think it's one of the first times it really... Well, I mean, I guess where No Man Has Been Gone Before, it's more direct, where he has to kill his friend in order to save the ship. But this, it's a casualty of war. And his zest for life gets slowly chipped away as a casualty of war. He has to do this to save his ship, to save most of the crew. But he doesn't always save all of them. And he didn't save Tomlinson. He walks away as the credits roll. The lonely man, forever on a trek. And that's what the episode's about. Okay. Okay, so that's the big overview of the episode. That's how the episode went. I told you I wasn't going to do a review of it, but I need to go through it point by point. Not for the plot, but to tell you why it's important, why you need to watch it, and I hope you watch it. And I hope you watch it even more after we're done talking to our guest. Last night, as I was thinking about this, I decided to email Lawrence Montaigne, who played Decius. Now, Decius, you probably don't, you know, who is that? Decius was one of the Romulan guys who is kind of, he's like the third in command on the Romulan ship. And he's the guy who's really bucking to destroy the Federation. He's that young guy who's like, I want to take everybody on. And he's the one who prods and pushes the Romulan commander into fighting. Had they just damaged the Enterprise and went back to the Romulan homeworld as the Romulan commander wanted to, there would have been a galactic war. Romulus would have declared war on the Federation and sent all of these invisible ships across the neutral zone, and there would have been a huge war. It's Decius's fault that he wanted to go back and, for the glory of the Emperor, destroy their opponent. Now, you can't blame him. I mean, he's trying to move up. In some ways, he's also like Captain Kirk. He had that before Captain Kirk was captain. He wanted to succeed. Lawrence Montaigne is also notable because he played the Vulcan suitor to Spock's wife, to Pring, Stong. He didn't have a lot of lines in that, and he was not super happy about that. But even more importantly than these two roles, and these are pretty important, was that when contract negotiations were breaking down between Leonard Nimoy and NBC, they started looking for someone else to play Spock. And Lawrence Montaigne was one of the few who was on the lists that they were actually considering. Him and Mark Leonard, interestingly enough, who would later on play Spock's father. But this guy was a Romulan, a Vulcan, and almost Spock. And so I emailed him last night, and to my surprise, he emailed me this morning, and he says he wants to talk today, but he reminds me that he's 85 years old, and that he says, don't expect me to be Mr. Nice Guy when it comes to talking about Star Trek. Well, I never expected that. I never wanted that. Let's call Lawrence.
Hello.
Hi, I'm looking for Lawrence.
Hang on.
Yeah?
Is this Lawrence?
Who's calling? Oh,
this is
Simon.
No, this is Mike McCafferty for the podcast. You emailed me this morning?
Oh, yeah. Mike, listen, you got some time. I'm sitting down at dinner right now.
You're sitting down at dinner?
Yeah.
Well, when...
I'm sorry. I should have told you later. Yeah.
That's all right.
How about a half an hour?
I'm gonna call you. How about I call you in like 45 minutes, Lawrence? Is that enough?
That's beautiful.
Great. I'm gonna call you back in 45 minutes. Have a good meal.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.
Sure. Bye. Bye. And now, through the magic of podcasting, we're gonna call back in 45 minutes.
Excuse me, Mike. You have a text message.
And I have a text message. Okay, I gave him 50 minutes. I give you 3 minutes for you and your brave crew. Search for Spock. Let's give him a call back. Let's see what's going on.
Hello.
Is this Lawrence?
Yes, sir.
Hey, Lawrence, Mike McCafferty again. How are you?
Yes, fine, Mike. How are you?
Good. How was dinner?
Very light. I'm going through some sort of a cold or something, and so I figured just to have some chicken soup, and that's it.
Oh.
But so I live. Yeah.
Well, good. Well, I'm glad. I didn't know there was that much at stake. Wow. Well, yeah, that's quite a dinner there, Lawrence. Now, Lawrence, thanks so much for talking to me. We're recording right now, if that's okay.
I see. When you say recording, is this for any particular purpose? I mean, any particular medium or something?
It's for a podcast.
I don't know what that is.
Oh, a podcast. So a podcast is sort of like a radio show, but on the internet, where you can download it and listen to it whenever you want.
I see.
Yeah, it came from the word iPod, and basically people just record sort of like little interviews and stuff, and they store them on their iPod and listen to them whenever they want. So it's sort of like the radio has become sort of segmented, and we can listen to it whenever we want now.
Great.
Yeah, so...
Great.
So people can listen to this from now until infinity and get something from it.
Well, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
All right. What can I do to share your program?
Well, that's just it. You know, I mean, I want to preface this by saying when I emailed you, you had some not complimentary things to say about Star Trek. Is this true?
I had a rush. I had a rush with Gene Roddenberry, and I had a brush with Leonard Nimoy.
Ooh.
And so I was not a very popular person on the set. I don't know. Did you read my book?
I read the chapter about your time at Star Trek. Yeah, so I know about that. Yeah, but please, first of all, tell us your book. What is the name of your book?
It's called A Vulcan Odyssey.
Uh-huh.
And it's an autobiographical novel.
Okay.
And it covers a lot of the Star Trek that I was involved in. There was some cute things in there that were very very poignant and not very complimentary to Leonard and not very complimentary to Gene, and I'm sure that they felt the same way about me. So it was a two-way street. What can I say? Help.
Well, you were a direct threat to Leonard Nimoy. They were considering you to be Spock in the third season, isn't that right? Or second season? I can't remember which.
You've got to understand. All right, let me just explain something so that you'll know where Leonard and I come from.
Sure.
His wife and I, Sandy Zober, we're in the theater together.
Oh.
The Players Ring Theater in Hollywood. When Sandy found out that I was going to be on the show, she came. She invited me for dinner. So I show up at the house, and Leonard's sitting at the dining table. I walk in, Leonard gets up, walks out. I never saw him again.
Oh, wow.
So, that'll give you some idea of how Leonard could be. I mean, there are certain words that I would use, but since it's radio, I would not dare to use those words. But he was rather something of a hole. Then when we worked together,
yeah,
you knew about this situation, I take it, when I was on the set and he was on the set sitting by himself, and I told him that story about the truckload of tourists.
No.
You remember that?
Well, I do remember. Can you refresh the people who are listening?
All right. I was on the set, I was playing a Vulcan in a mock time, and they called for lunch. First of all, I came on the set earlier in the day. Leonard was sitting off by himself in his director's chair and did not acknowledge me. I didn't acknowledge him. Fine. That was okay. Lunch was called. And I went over to the commissary. I walked over to the commissary. I went into the commissary. As I was walking into the commissary, a bus pulled up, loaded with tourists. And I went into the commissary and sat down and had ordered my lunch. And people from the bus came into the commissary, saw me, and made a mad dash for my table. Mr. Nimoy, can we have your autograph? Okay.
Uh-huh.
So I'm sitting there, and I'm signing Leonard Nimoy's autograph, his name. I go back after lunch to the set, and Leonard's still sitting in his chair. I walked over, and I said, hello, Leonard. I said, I thought you'd get a kick out of this. I said, but I was at the commissary. I said, and this this busload of tourists came into the commissary, and they saw me, and they made a mad dash to my table, saying, oh, Mr. Nimoy, can I have your autograph? And I told them all to go F themselves.
So you changed it up a little bit. You changed the conditions.
So that did not sit too well with him.
Oh.
So that was another incident, and I didn't endear myself to Leonard. But that was not what I was there for. I was there to work on the show and not to endear myself to him. So that was fine. Let's see, anything else?
You know, in this podcast, in this specific one, I mean, I love this. These are all great stories. And I know, you know, you were almost considered to be Spock when you're in contract negotiation, but we're talking about right now about the balance of terror. Let's go back to your first episode a little bit, if you don't mind.
No, not at all. I had come from Europe, and I was a little out of it. I was trying to get my footing.
Why were you in Europe? Can I ask why you're in Europe?
I lived in Europe. I mean, Europe was my home.
Oh, okay.
When my agent called up and said, you know, Lawrence, you've got an interview on a show called Star Trek. And I said, what's a Star Trek?
Yep.
And he said, it's going to be a very popular show. It's going to be a science fiction popular show.
Oh.
I said, okay, well, great, I'll go for the interview. And I went to the interview, and I walked in, and Gene Roddenberry was there, and director, and they wanted me, bear with me on this, because it's come back a long time, and I don't remember every detail. They wanted me to shave my chest.
What?
And I did not, I'd worked out and been, you know, and knew what shaving your chest meant. It meant that, you know, long time of scratching and itching and everything.
Yeah.
I said, no, I didn't think I wanted to do that. And they said, well, you know, this is what the director wants. And so I said no, and they called up my agent. My agent came down. They had a long conference, and they finally said, well, here's the deal. You don't have to shave your chest. We'll just put a little vest on you. And so that's the way it was. But Gene was a little PO'd and stayed PO'd about that incident.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a major incident or anything like that. But I think he carried it with him for a long time.
Wow.
So I don't
understand, like, why would they want you? I mean, the outfits that they eventually put you guys in were fully, like, almost like turtlenecks. I mean, you guys are completely clothed. Why would they want you to shave your chest?
Because at the beginning, it wasn't a turtleneck. It was originally cut down.
Oh, wow. Shirtless Romulans. I love that. Can you imagine that? So you sort of changed possibly the next 50 years of wardrobe for the Romulans by refusing to shave your chest.
Say it again.
Yes. So by you not shaving your chest, you changed the wardrobe choices of the Romulans for the next 50 years. Otherwise, they would have been running around shirtless, right? They could have been a whole bunch of shirtless, like, weird guys, right?
Yeah, you know, don't hold me to this, will you? I'll tell you what. It's either a Romulan or the Vulcan. I forgot which incident it was.
Oh.
It was one of the two. And right now, I'm in a little days, and I'm not sure which one it was.
I bet you it's the Vulcan one. I'm going to say it's the Vulcan one because you were sort of shirtless in that, and that makes more sense. And
all right. That could very well could be.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I mean, it certainly makes more sense for that. But
yeah, if you think so, no, that's by all means. I'm in the daze.
You've got a slight cold, Lawrence, and we're going to get you through this, man.
I do have a slight cold, and my wife gave it to me.
Oh.
So we're on the edge of a divorce. To pay her back, and of course she's been waiting for me to say that for years. All right.
A-list material. I love this. This is great. So tell me. These are great stories. Tell me a little bit about like working on the set of The Balance of Terror. You didn't have any interaction with any of the main cast. It was you and Mark Leonard and a couple other guys.
Yeah. I never saw anybody. Mark Leonard and I were. In fact, we had just come off another show together.
Yep.
Called Here Come the Brides.
Oh.
Here Come the Brides, something like that. It was a show. God, wish I could help you on this.
People can look it up later.
Something about the brides. Yeah, you can look it up. So we got along great on that show, and then we showed up on the Star Trek show, and the thing was I had read for the part of the commander.
Right.
And I did not get it. And my agent said, you didn't get the role. And I said, oh my, and he said, but the good part is that you did get the second, you did get the second choice. And playing the character. So when I showed up on the set, there was Mark Leonard. And it was like a reunion, and we got along great, and we had these wonderful scenes together. And of course, I was responsible for getting us all killed, which I always love, you know. We had a great rapport, but I didn't have any interplay with anybody else, and I had worked. I had worked with Bill Shatner on I'm sitting here in a vacuum on another science fiction show.
Okay.
And I had worked with him on that, so I was looking forward to working with him on this show, and never got a chance to because we were we'd sit around together in director's chairs, these little comfortable chairs, sitting around just shooting the bull, but we never actually worked together. We never played together.
Right.
So that was unfortunate because I'd met him on occasion, and that was it.
And Shatner was okay to you. He was like, Nimoy was really cold. Shatner was cool, right?
Exactly. But I've spoken to other people. It's just the other way around.
Yep.
So I guess it's just the way you're fortunate or misfortunate to show up and I was fortunate to be a friendly with Bill Shatner and not so friendly with Leonard Nimoy.
Right.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Well, but I mean, with The Balance of Terror as well as with Amok Time, you're essentially playing his role. I mean, in Balance of Terror, you are the one who's the aggressive, stoic one who's saying we've got to destroy him, just like Spock was on his side in his ship. So
you do know the story behind Balance of Terror.
What's that?
You do know the story behind Balance of Terror.
Tell me.
All right. Well, there was a film with Robert Mitchum.
Yes.
Called The Enemy Below.
Yes.
With Kurt Jurgens.
Okay.
And Robert Mitchum.
Yes.
And it was the and The Enemy Below was the film that this show Balance of Terror was taken from.
Yes. So
almost exactly. And so and I played the same role The Enemy Below.
Now, had you seen The Balance or The Enemy Below before you played this role?
Yes,
or no?
I did.
Okay.
I didn't know that one had anything to do with the other. It only dawned on me after a while, after I'd read the script. I said, gee, this is familiar, you know.
Yeah.
And then I got on the set and I was talking to Mark, and I surmised that this was, it was taken from that film.
It's a submarine film. It's a submarine versus
yes,
destroyer. It's
a submarine stalking a cargo vessel.
Right. So, yeah. So, but I mean, it was good cloth to pull from, right? I mean, you know, it wasn't a bad story. I mean, you know, if you're going to pull from something.
No, if it was good enough to. Hey, I thought it was a compliment to build a show around a fine film. Like The Enemy Below, because it was a fine film.
Right. So,
yeah.
Now, Lawrence, I want to go back to one thing you said. You like to joke that you're the one who got the Romulan warbird destroyed, but can I spin it to a different way?
Sure.
So, I mean, first of all, you're following orders, right? I mean, you're doing what the Praetor wants. So, I mean,
yes.
I mean, the Romulan commander is not. He your orders are to destroy any enemy vessels, and he did not. So, first of all, he is in default of his responsibilities. Secondly, from a larger standpoint, let's say that Mark Leonard, the Romulan commander, like you stand down from him and you guys go home. Well, as he said earlier, the Praetor is going to say, hey, let's have a war. There could be a huge galactic war because you didn't stand up and say, no, we have to follow our duty. It's because of you that there was not a huge war where billions of fictional lives were killed.
You know, how long are we talking about? We're talking about, what, 50 years?
Yes, it's the 50th anniversary. Do you know that?
Yeah, yes, I do. And I also want to bring something else up.
Yeah.
On the 50th anniversary.
Please.
That, you know, it's been 50 years since I worked on that show. And I've gone to a lot of conventions.
Yes.
A lot of Star Trek conventions. And in the original, when I was invited to go to Star Trek conventions, we showed up and we were given our costumes and everything, and we had our contracts, and we were going to charge so much for a photograph, and that was fine. Everyone thought that was great. Then a few years went by, and we get a call, and we said, "Well, we've got to pay. You've got to pay for your table."
Oh.
All right. How much do we have to pay? $250. All right. That's not too bad. I mean, you know, it was still early, and $250 we pay. All right. That went on for a number of years. Then for 50th anniversary, we learned that we're going to pay $400 for our table.
Oh.
Now I feel very very. Reticent to pay for something like that because I created a character. I created two characters, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
And I feel that that they, excuse the expression, they owe me.
They do.
To show up and to put my pictures out and to greet the fans and be friendly and everything and build up their convention. They don't feel that way about it. And a lot of other people feel the way about it, and I won't mention any names, because I've spoken to a lot of actors who say, I'm not showing up.
Good.
And I feel the same way. I am not showing up. This should be this should be written in the wind, that we should be paid for our table. If not pay for the table, at least not having to pay for the table.
Yep.
And so I feel, and it's not this year, it's not, every year it's been, of course, the creation. But this year I understand it's not creation. I hear it's CBS or someone that's taken over the uh, the show this year.
Oh, okay.
Vaguely. I don't want to say something and put my foot in it, but someone else has taken over the show and charging this money, and I won't pay it. I hope any of the actors, self-respecting actors, refuse to pay it too, because I find that reprehensible. And so that's the way I feel about it. I'm entitled. Yeah.
Absolutely. You are one of the originals. You're of the body. You have been doing this long enough that you get your say on this. And I think it's ridiculous that they would, you should have some sort of emeritus status where anyone who's been on the original series can show up, they get a table, they get to do what they want.
I thought so. And unfortunately, they don't feel the same way. So as they say in French, screw them.
Ah, yeah. That is outstanding. That's great. Wow. Gosh, Lawrence, this is great. I would be remiss. You've had such a storied career. You've done so much stuff. I'm looking at your IMDb. You did Batman. You did.
Yeah, but you know, we're sitting here and we're talking about my career, and we're talking about Star Trek.
Yeah.
And all the series, the Batman, and all this stuff, and combat, and God knows, I can sit here and go for an hour about talking about these things if I could remember them. But the one thing that is my key to all of this, the one show that is my key to everything,
uh-huh,
is The Great Escape.
Right. You were in The Great Escape. Tell me.
Yes, I was. And I was in Europe when I was picked up by the Mirisch Company to play the role of Haynes in The Great Escape. And I did this, and it was a 5-week contract that went into 6 months, or 20 weeks. It went into 20 weeks, and then the company, I parted with the company. I went off doing my thing in the Far East, and then came back to Germany, and I was advised to go back to the United States, and which I did. And now when I get back to the United States, it's like a year or two after we've done the Great Escape. So The Great Escape is now first being released. And when I go to visit the producers of the film that I did with Guy Williams, and that was also in Germany, Captain Sinbad, with Guy Williams, and the King brothers, Maury King, said, well, what are your plans? And I said, well, I've got to get an agent. And he said, wait a second, picks up the phone, and he calls up this agent, and he says, I've got Lawrence Montaigne here, he's in The Great Escape, and he worked for me on this picture, and you've got to see him. And I was 5 minutes later, I was on the road walking over to this agent's office, and this is what started my career in Hollywood.
Wow.
Otherwise, I have nothing to say about Hollywood, because I had no one knew me from Adam.
Wow.
But when that picture, The Great Escape, came out, all of a sudden, I was known, and I was given an open door, and it was great. I mean, it was beautiful, because I don't know if you've seen The Great Escape or you haven't, or you know anything about it, but I felt that it was one of the better war films made, and with some of the better actors around, that some of the best European actors, Richard Attenborough and Donald Pleasence, and some of the great American actors, of course, Steve McQueen. I won't go on and on and on, but I mean, this was a classic film. And I was honored to be in it.
Wow.
You know.
Well, so, such a great way to start out your career with all those great names, and Queen, James Garner, Charles Bronson. I mean, just so many great people. And then.
Absolutely. But you realize I have been living in Europe, working in Europe all these years. It wasn't as if I wasn't an actor before then.
Sure.
I was an actor. I was working in Europe. I starred in a dozen European films, Italy and in Germany and Israel. So I've been all over the bloody place, you know, working my butt off. But no one knew because these films never came to the United States.
Right.
These were European films.
So this got you. This was your calling card. Finally, you finally hit it.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. The Great Escape was by far, my calling card, and it was so great to have that entree, you know, and that's the way I got in. Yeah.
That movie helped you escape Europe, Lawrence, to get to the Hollywood, which is...
Well, I always, in the book I wrote, every actor should have a great escape.
Outstanding. That's great. So you wrote this book. You also have a couple other books I saw, a couple other novels you've written.
Yeah, novels, yeah.
And those are on your website? Can they also be on Amazon? Or where can...
Yeah, sure, on Amazon. They are on Amazon. Yes.
Okay. And those are detective? Or they're... what
strictly, I think it's strictly. Well, one's a detective... And the other one is a film that I wrote for Steve McQueen.
Oh.
And we were working on it, and in the course of writing this book, Steve went down to Mexico and died. And I had this book sitting on the shelf for 40 years. And 50 years, and it was, I just put it on the shelf. I was so disheartened about it, about Steve dying and all that stuff. And then, I got in touch with, we had a thing with Steve Stuntman. Can you help me? All right, I'll remember.
Yeah, you're on your own on that.
This is terrible. Don't ever get old. Yeah. Oh, this is terrible.
I'm trying not to.
Got in touch with him, and he said, you know, you ought to make a book out of that. And I said, well, you know, it's kind of a motorcycle thing. Who wants to read a motorcycle film? And he said, it was good enough for Steve to get involved in it. He said, you ought to do it. So I got started working on it, and I had some people in a writing group here in Anthem in Henderson, Nevada, and they encouraged me, and I wrote it, and that's exactly what it was. It was a 1920s motorcycle book about a motorcycle thing.
Oh.
It had its moments, but... Everybody dies shortly after they know me.
I don't like that, Lawrence. No, I got to be honest. I mean, we're just talking, Lawrence. Help me out here, man.
Sorry about that. Yeah,
we're just acquaintances. We're not friends. All right. Let's just keep it at that. All right.
Okay.
Hey, Lawrence. I have to ask you two other things, and then I'll let you go.
Please, no. My time is your time. Yeah,
oh,
please.
Well, it's not. I could talk to you all day, but I know my wife and kids are coming home soon, and they'll be.
I got you. Okay.
I gaggle things, but I was I had forgotten, and I blocked this in my mind that you were part of the terrifying Disney film Escape to Witch Mountain.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that in years and years, but that thing scared the crap out of me as a kid. Do you know that? You terrified kids for years and years after that. You played Uberman.
No wonder people want to grab their kids and move out of the way when I walk down the street.
Yeah, exactly. Because you're one of the bad guys. You're trying to grab the kids, right?
Well, not only grab the kids, but remember the scene where I pull out the gun and I'm the kids are in the motor van.
Yeah.
And I've got my gun out, and the cat is up in a tree, and he jumps down and jumps on my wrist, and I drop the gun.
Oh, God. Yeah.
You remember this?
Ah, barely. Yes.
And the kids love this. Of course, here's the bad part. I got to tell you the bad part. I pick up the paper the other day. This is 2016, right?
Right.
I pick up the paper the other day, and I read this horrible, horrible story. little girl who has grown up and is now into drugs and every other damn thing, and it just breaks my heart. She was so sweet. She was such a marvelous little actress, and to think that, that some way she got off the track. She got off the, because she had a great career going.
Yeah.
I'm rambling. I don't mean to do that.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
It broke my heart, and so I had to share that with you, because I got to tell you, she was lovely. She was just so, and her mother was so concerned about her all the time.
Mm.
And I remember having wonderful conversations with them, and spending wonderful hours with them. So I was really upset. Okay, so much for that.
Well,
so let's go on.
Although I'm looking at her IMDb, and it says that she was in Sharknado 3. Do you know that show? Have you ever heard of that? Sharknado?
No. Who are we talking about now? Do you got a name?
The little girl, Tia? Yeah. Like Kim Richards. It says like she...
Kim Richards. There you go.
Yeah.
Kim Richards. And she had a sister who played her double.
Oh.
In the water. Her sister was in the water and did the swimming for her, which was kind of cute. And but Kim was so marvelous. Marvelous. And then on the second show, Return to Witch Mountain, I wasn't killed in the first show, but I was for some reason I couldn't do the second show, but I was a dialogue director.
Oh.
So in the second show I was on the set again for the whole show, and then in the interim I had written a film called, The Million Dollar Dixie Deliverance, a Civil War film.
Oh, okay.
And I came to work one day, the producer, who was a very good friend of mine, came on the set, and he said, Lawrence, he said, I have some good news and some bad news for you. And I said, I said, what's the bad news? He says, you're fired.
Oh.
And I said, oh, God. I said, well, Jesus, what's the good news? He said, we got the okay to go ahead on your film. You're going down to Georgia.
Oh.
As associate producer on the film. And so being that close was so marvelous, being so wonderful. You know, all these things tie in. It's wonderful because, you know, it's in my career, it was strange because I not only did the writing, I not only did the acting and the stunt work and the dancing, but I did all these things in this big melting pot called showbiz, and I was fortunate to be able to do all that stuff. You know, in the interim, I went to school, I got my master's degree, I got, you know, so I wasn't just a dumb little actor just bouncing off the walls. I felt that I was very serious about being an actor at the time, you know, and very serious about being involved.
Well, I mean,
you put you to sleep, yeah.
No, not at all. No, I mean, you're spinning out gold here. I mean, this is so much better than the past, you know, everything else I've done. This is so great. I mean, you have the floor, so I don't mind, you know, letting you, you know, spin these wise tales here.
Yeah.
Well, this has been great, Lawrence. I appreciate so much you getting back to me so quick and saying, yeah, let's talk so I can, you know. Have my piece about this convention stuff, but you've given us so much more. Give me so much more on this, and I'm so appreciative of this. Thank you so much for talking.
Hey, I appreciate your getting in touch with me, and I appreciate your recognizing my work. So that's I'm the one who appreciates you. You know.
Oh.
So there.
Wow.
So take that.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, this is great. This is wonderful. Can I ask one more favor of you?
Yeah, absolutely.
My favorite.
Oh, you want money? Okay.
Yeah, this has all been a Ponzi scheme. I hope you don't mind.
Yeah, I got it. Okay.
We're outside your house right now. If you could just lend us your car, we'll give it back to you.
Okay.
No, not at all. No, one of my favorite lines in Star Trek is when you're staring at the monitor after the Enterprise has been hit by that nuclear weapon, and do you remember what you say? You repeat the one word twice. Do you remember that? You're staring at the screen after the nuclear bomb has hit the Enterprise, and you're looking at it, and you're excited, and you say one word twice. It's all right. I'll give it to you. You say glorious. Do you remember saying that? Glorious. Glorious.
Is that what I said?
Yes. Oh, God, it's so good. It's so good. It's there's something.
Oh, I said something else that became a classic. And I can't remember it again. I can't remember it. When I will send you an email. there was a classic line that I said. There it is. Permit me the glory of the kill.
Yeah, that's another good one too. That's a great one.
That was the one I liked. And when fans come up to the table and they say, "Oh, you're the guy who said, permit me the glory of the kill," and I say, "Oh yeah, that's me," you know. Oh, that was so beautiful. That was a good line, and I appreciated that. Yeah.
Oh, but they can have their favorite, but they're not 100% right because it came before that. It's when you looked at the monitor and you said, "Glorious, glorious," and you were so excited that the Enterprise had been damaged that the commander had said, "Can you give me that line one more time? Just that glorious, glorious, one more time, just like so." Like let's relive the situation. We've loaded the nuclear explosive in there. It's hit the Enterprise and you're staring at it right now.
Huh?
Oh, okay. So.
Wait. This wasn't an acting job. Radio. You want an acting job? Call my agent. I mean, what the hell are we doing here?
We're paying scale, Lawrence. I don't know what you want, man. I mean,
no,
come on.
Scale, you know, you can show us the scale. I don't work for scale.
Oh, you're killing me. No, I just need to hear it one more time from the master's lips.
Oh, I see. Well, one more time, I'll give you glorious. Glorious. Great.
That's all I needed. That's the God.
Oh, God.
No.
Oh, on top of everything else, it makes me look bad. Okay, get the hell out of here.
No.
Have a great show.
What?
If there's anything I can do to help you in any way,
no.
Pick up the phone, call, or email me. And like I said, I do appreciate your remembering and taking the time.
Well,
okay.
Yeah, and I'm sorry you're not going to be at the Star Trek convention. I'm going to be out there. Maybe I'll give you a jingle. Maybe we can stop by, have lunch. What do you think about
that? Sounds like a winner.
There we
sounds
go.
Sounds like a winner.
Now we're back to being friends. See? Now we're friends again. All right.
You've got it.
All right, Lawrence, you have a great rest of your day, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Mike. Okay, buddy. Bye-bye now.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Well, he's not going to say it, but I am. Glorious. Glorious. What a great interview. This guy, he's painted the edges of Star Trek. He's been a Vulcan and he's been a Romulan. He defined what a Romulan is and he helped shape what Vulcans were. Decius, Stun, McCafferty. The three greats of Star Trek peripheral lore. And you got to listen to that. You bear witness to that greatness. I am great, you are great. The ultimate computer. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about the balance of terror. The balance of glory, more like. Am I right? Yes, I am. And you are right for listening to this. You are great. I am great. I am Mike McCafferty, and I just want to talk about Star Trek.
Distract sequence completed and engaged.
Don't you understand?
Non-sequitur, your facts are uncoordinated.
Feral Audio.
Hello,
I'm Dave Ross.
Hey, and I'm Hampton Yunt.
And we host Suicide Buddies on Starburns Audio.
That's right. It's a podcast about suicide, but not to make light of it. We actually talk about suicidal thoughts, depression, kind of with a sense of levity that Dave and I have with each other. And he's my best friend. Come on.
Yeah, we're buddies. Suicide Buddies.
That's the title.
One of our favorite episodes that we've recorded so far is about this guy, Jan Pataki, who was a Polish aristocrat in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And he, one of the reasons it's possible that he killed himself is that he thought he was a werewolf.
Oh.
Check out a clip. It also makes me think, like, we were talking about in the Norway black metal episode, how, like, just the culture of your surroundings can affect you. Like, yeah. He's in a castle in Poland. He's like, I mean, if you lived in a castle in Poland and no one knew anything about anything, you might be like, I'm a bat. I'm probably a bat.
That's like literally what happened to Batman. He literally is in his mansion. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I'm a bat.
I'm a
bat that helps people.
I'm a bat that helps people.
I'm a rich...
I don't know what you want from me. And my girlfriend, she's a cat. She's a cat.
My girlfriend's a cat.
She steals things. She's a woman who steals things. She's a cat. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat.
I help people.
She's a cat. We fight a penguin.
My